The American Medical Association says more than 80% of doctors now use AI professionally, and that's double the number of doctors who told the AMA they used AI in 2023. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. AI in medicine is one of the topics that will be explored in Northern Kentucky University's upcoming Born Before AI lecture series. Joining me now to discuss how AI is affecting healthcare are Cincinnati AI Catalyst Executive Director Carl Frake, Dean of Northern Kentucky University's College of Informatics Kevin Kirby, and Executive Director of NKU's Institute for Health Innovation Valerie Hardcastle. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Valerie, I know the name of your upcoming lecture is AI and Medicine. Neither side knows what it's doing, and that's actually good news. Why is that good news?
Well, that's a very long answer. So I'd say you should come see the lecture so you'll get all the details. But in a nutshell, I think there's in some ways a fundamental misfit between what is going on in the AI laboratories and then what healthcare requires for a significant shift in its business practices. So in the AI laboratories, things are moving along at a lightning pace, and every day, it seems like we're getting more and more information about the spectacular things that it can do. And I'm sure myself and my colleagues will talk about those in the moment. And then on the other hand, we still have a lot of medical practices that are still completely paper-based. We have systems that can't talk to each other. We have incredible regulation over behavior and what types of treatments and how those treatments can be administered. We have governmental blocks on getting things that AI could do passed by the FDA so that it could then impact healthcare. And while I'm not suggesting that that impasse is exactly a good thing, on the other hand, mistakes can be extremely, extremely costly when they don't go well. And so it's really, I think, going to be a slow evolution and chipping around the edges, which is what you want when you have any sort of large transformation that's going to impact virtually everyone's health going forward.
Sure, it's not just a flip the switch kind of situation.
Right.
Yeah. So Valerie, how are doctors and other healthcare professionals who are using AI, how are they using it? What are the most common ways?
The most common way is in charting. And there are two reasons for it. One, doctors spend the majority of their time, over 50% of their time, maintaining patient records. And that's time they could be, say, seeing patients. And so anything that they can do to help relieve them of that onerous task would be terrific. But secondly, that's a real business function of medical care. And so it doesn't have the same sort of regulatory red tape that you might have with, say, getting a new treatment to patients. And so it's a way to improve workflow, but it's outside the actual medical workflow. So it's easier to get implemented. So it's an easy fix. People understand it, and there's less regulation around it.
Carl, what are doctors and healthcare providers learning about the benefits of AI as a technology, where it can really improve care or their business practices meaningfully beyond these controlled research settings where we see all these studies and results?
Yeah, what's really important in AI as a tool in totality is its ability to look at the metadata and really to find patterns. And in medicine, that is incredibly beneficial. And so if you specifically just think about scans, CTs, those kinds of things, there's a huge amount going on just right here in Cincinnati, particularly Children's Hospital, UC system, where they are using patient history, bringing that together with the data that's available there, and then the scan data, being able to then put all that together, and then the AI actually being able to see patterns by putting together the data that it's seeing in the scan plus the historical data to be able to see things that, from a pattern standpoint, a human, regardless of their skill set, are not able to see.
Hmm. Kevin, where does the performance of AI tend to break down?
Well, there's been an interesting trajectory since the time a few years ago when, say, you'd have a radiologist sitting next to AI, they'd be analyzing a scan together. As time's progressed, it's not just pattern classification and pattern recognition. As people have pointed out, it's extraordinarily competent in identifying patterns. But of course, as people know, we're talking to AI now. We're talking to these large language models that have read the internet, viewed the internet, and have made these vast associations. And one of the things that a lot of people associate with it, Valerie mentioned the word, is mistakes, hallucinations. So taking us through that era is very important. So one of the things we'll try to explain in the lecture series is, what is it under the hood in AI, these large neural networks with trillions of connections, that makes them at base untrustworthy? But yet, what extra layers have researchers and developers added on so that they can be trustworthy enough for healthcare organizations? For example, there's a tool, I believe Children's Hospital is beginning to use it through Hippocratic AI. You can have chats with potential patients. There's a very sophisticated large language model underneath it, but wrapped with many, many different layers to create this very important layer of trust. Mm-hmm.
To avoid those hallucinations and mistakes.
Exactly.
That's especially scary when you're talking about healthcare and diagnosing and figuring out a course of treatment.
Indeed. You hear a lot of enthusiasm around AI. You can vibe code, it'll develop a really cool website for you. And that is really awesome. I've done it. Actually would teach neural network AI. But the other layer, when you turn to areas, cybersecurity, defense, and especially healthcare, the R&D has to be really on point for this. So there's a certain amount of caution that large healthcare organizations are undertaking now.
Yeah. We're talking about the impact that AI is having on medicine and healthcare. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Valerie, how narrowly does a health problem have to be defined for AI to be effective? I guess, does AI really struggle with ambiguity?
Well, in many ways, AI finds the patterns in ambiguity, which is what gives it its power. But on the other hand, it can only find patterns in things that we can give it, which is turning out to be problematic in ways we hadn't thought through. So for example, an AI system can review, say, 5 million scans, whereas your average cardiologist might see 50,000 patients in a year, which is less than, you know, 0.5% of what an AI system can do. But if they're only looking at scans from one type of machine, when there are different models out there, they'll find patterns there that don't necessarily translate into the other machines. And these are like subtle differences that we're only discovering now, because to the human eye, an MRI scan from here and an MRI scan from there look the same to the human vision. But when you look at the detailed patterns underneath, the slightly different programs that different systems have, the slightly different codings actually makes a difference in the sensitivity of the patterns and the resultant generalizations that the AI systems come up with. And so it's trying to tease out exactly how to manage what, how to think about that and what to do about it, and then how to translate that into healthcare, I think is where healthcare is right now.
Carl, I find that so interesting because, you know, you were talking about how good AI is at finding these patterns and seeing all this, but it always comes down to what we feed into it, right? So what is the challenge? What's the balance of making sure you're feeding the machine what it needs to do a good job for the people it's, you know, the technology is trying to serve?
So patient data has to be, of course, clean. There are a number of existing companies, but a lot of startups also, that are really focusing on methodologies of getting the data from the historical systems and keeping that clean as it relates to what the AI is going to be looking for historical patterns. The equipment and the systems that are supporting the equipment that's in the industry now, that's a really high priority. So, you know, so for existing scans, I don't think that's much to be concerned about. The Cincinnati region, though, I do want to mention there are some very specific things in our region that are gifts for us. Actually, the University of Cincinnati is the leading global fuzzy AI methodology university. Dr. Kelly Cohen leads a laboratory there that's focused on trustworthy and explainable AI. And just as an example, there is a startup in Cincinnati called Genexia that is actually, imagine your mammogram. You know, generally you think about that just for breast cancer, but they actually have found that there are signals that come from mammograms that also are indicative of coronary artery disease. Oh. And so, and they're in the clinicals now. So as an outcome of that, assuming the clinicals come through, when you get a woman gets a mammogram, they're also going to get signals around whether they're at risk for coronary disease.
Wow, so important. That's such a huge problem for women too. Kevin, when we think of AI, a lot of us think of chatbots, for better or worse.
Yes.
What are the limitations of patient-facing chatbots, that patient-facing AI that people might be tempted to use on their own or that healthcare providers are encouraging you to use as a starting point?
Well, there are many different limitations. Most basic one is whenever you're using a tool, you're going online chatting with someone, do you trust the source, whether it's a website or a chatbot? Right now, we're at a place where I can use a foundation model on my own laptop. I can align it to spew all sorts of terrible, inappropriate stuff. I can load it up with hallucinations and try and convince you to come to my website and trust it for advice. So there's that sort of consumer beware aspect to it, which again means turns towards trusted organizations, trusted healthcare organizations that use trusted models underneath. I think a lot of it is generalized awareness of the subtle issues of what it means to trust AI, signs that it's not trustworthy, trends that real organizations are putting into place, especially in new areas like AI agents. Who are you talking to? Is that a team of experts? Are they human? Are they not? Again, this is one of the themes we'll try to address over multiple sessions in our lecture series at NKU, not just healthcare, but how AI agents work, AI and ethics, and then how it works.
Yeah. Valerie, is there a risk that a patient might be tempted to put almost too much trust in a chatbot that seems so certain about something, even when maybe it's wrong?
That's a very good question. And I have to say, chatbots are not my area. So I will just speak from personal experience. And really, my issue with chatbots is, at least the ones that are publicly available on reputable sites that are trying to help you with healthcare issues, is they are so limited. And that, you know, I could do a 5-second search on the web and come up with exactly the same answers that the chatbot is telling me. So I don't, that's one reason I don't pay much attention to them, because I don't find them helpful at all. I just find them an impediment, because generally when I'm turning to a chatbot, that means I can't find it on the web, which means they don't know either, and I need to speak to an actual human expert at this point.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to weigh in on that, Kevin?
Yes, that's actually the interesting paradox, right? When they seem limited, it's because the guardrails are tight for very good reasons, because they're talking about difficult stuff. I'm sure many of our listeners have just had a free-form conversation with the chatbot, give me some ideas about a novel and let it ramble, and that can be quite difficult. The interesting thing is, when a chatbot goes off the rails, we can't just debug it and fix it in the usual way. You have to, the Wall Street Journal used a very interesting word, you have to cajole the large language model, align it to be appropriate. It's a very different type of control than what we're used to in tech.
I wonder, Kevin or Carl, do you know if more people are turning to chatbots to try to diagnose health problems because they can't afford to go to a doctor maybe, or there's some other barrier between, you know, themselves and a medical professional?
Yep. In rural settings, consumers in a lot of cases are having no choice. You know, they're losing their health insurance. Rural hospitals are closing at an alarming rate. And so people have to get the expertise that's available to them. Interestingly enough, yesterday was International Fact-Checking Day. One of the things that, you know, we're encouraging people to do is, you know, before you react, before you share, before you conclude, check your sources, right? And so you know, if you think for a setting where you only get a chance to talk to a primary care provider in a rural clinic, there is a benefit in terms of using AI as a tool to structure a conversation. But as my colleagues have been saying, it is not the replacement for a medical professional. But it does provide at least an opportunity to organize your thoughts.
Kevin, how tough is it to know when AI is right and when it's, you know, I think that's the thing that worries so many of us when we first started hearing about this, the hallucinations, the just saying stuff that's wrong. Is that a big challenge here?
It is a challenge. When you read a source that may or may not be trustworthy, it's a static source that sits there. You can read it and you can check. With chatbots, you are having a conversation. And Dr. Hardcastle and I have talked about cases where you can have an argument with a chatbot that swears it's correct. You know it's not. Then it corrects itself, apologizes for its error, but its correction in turn is incorrect. So there's this very interesting layer here. And as more and more people turn to them, although not specifically about healthcare, the Pew Research Organization released a study last October that said of adults 65 and over, 46% of them are accessing AI several times a week. That's a fast change.
Really?
That actually took me by surprise. It's changing fast, which so the more we can do to get people to understand some of the challenges and implications of AI from under the hood to ethics becomes important.
Yeah. So, Carl, there are lots of things AI is doing in terms of medical research. Can you talk to us about AI being on the cutting edge of medical discoveries? What's happening there?
So there probably have been folks in this room before talking about the Google acquisition of DeepMind and AlphaFold, which is, you know, incredibly important scientific breakthrough on protein folding. That has set up the ability to dramatically reduce the time to determine whether the combinations in drug discovery make any sense or not, because again, it's the probability of something happening, but also there are AI capabilities now that have dramatically reduced the process of deciding whether how a molecule will connect to again to proteins as basically the binding that would be necessary for a drug to perform. And so, as these methods of, you know, because there's so many new methods of how AI actually is being executed, it's pharma is a really important aspect of that.
Yeah. Valerie, does all of this point to AI being a better teammate for doctors and nurses rather than a replacement?
I think it does, at least for now. Anyway, because there is something to be said about the human touch, and it's not medicine. The practice of medicine, it's a practice. The practice of medicine is not just about defining an illness and then providing a cure or treatment for it. It really is a human to human interaction, and it's a relationship built over time. Because what you're trying to do over time, perhaps, is change human behavior. And right now, humans are much better equipped and in a personal interaction to be able to work on changing human behavior than a chatbot is or something else. I think right now where AI can work its magic is, as has been said, particularly in the area of pharma, it's finding the patterns in the data that humans are less good at right now. But right now, we're still better at the human-to-human interactions, which is kind of the problem with chatbots.
We got a call from Lee, who couldn't stay on the line, but Lee said she noticed errors in her chart notes and is wondering if AI could be responsible for that. Is AI making, you mentioned they're using AI, a lot of professionals are using AI for charting. Does it make mistakes there?
It certainly could. Humans also make mistakes. So it kind of depends on what the mistake is.
Sure.
Because what the AI is doing is recording what the doctor said. yep. in some fashion and making notes from that. So I don't know. Could be, could not be.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are transcription tools. And one of the very, very clear disclaimers, I mean, there's this huge company called Epic that basically all the major health providers use. And they have very, very clear instructions for the health providers that this is a transcription tool. You save an incredible amount of time with that tool. But then before you make your final comments as a medical provider, you have to read.
Right. Proofreading is important.
That's right.
The journalism profession can tell us all that. That's for sure. So, Valerie, is the average hospital being transformed by AI?
I would say it is not being transformed yet, except in some the areas of transcription and getting notes being done. But I would suspect over the next decade, as we get more and more things approved through FDA approval, we get it better integrated into the workflow, then we will start to see changes. But I suspect healthcare is going to be a very slow mover in this field, just because mistakes are so, so costly. And you never want to do anything that is going to discourage a patient from coming in out of fear that somehow they're going to be maltreated or mistreated.
Yeah. Carl and Kevin, we only have like 40 seconds left, but does that mean healthcare is going to be AI's hardest test with the stakes being so high?
It's hard to say which is the hardest. It's certainly one of the hardest. The whole technological infrastructure of the world, cybersecurity also depends on software. Software is fragile. It will depend on AI. That's a scary application too.
Okay.
So there's a company called Ensemble Health Partners based here in Cincinnati in Blue Ash, and they are really growing at a rapid pace in terms of helping hospital administrators with a whole host of reductions and improvements in productivity. So actually in our own backyard here, I think we have a really good example where healthcare is being addressed now, and that is reducing costs. And of course, we know the United States healthcare, a huge percentage of healthcare in the United States is administration.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Dean of Northern Kentucky University's College of Informatics, Kevin Kirby, Executive Director of NKU's Institute for Health Innovation, Valerie Hardcastle, and Cincinnati AI Catalyst Executive Director, Carl Frake. Thank you all so much for your time today. NKU's Born Before AI lecture series starts Friday. You can find a link with more information on our website at wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.